Hello, my name is Dit. You're listening to Type Radio. Now we're talking. In fact, my name is Bruce Conyeu. You're listening to Type Radio. Now we're talking.
Type Radio.
Just my type.
You also traveled to the border of Thailand and Burma and did a project there. Travel is very important. It seems to be a lot of you because you move on. Is that also because you are in New Zealand and very far away, you have this urge to see the rest of the world?
Perhaps it is. Maybe it's an island mentality. I'm not sure. And I haven't considered that, why I might travel. I mean, the work that I did in Burma,
That was quite an adventure, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And the motivations are never... are never simple. Even when you head off to do something, I mean, I watch war photographers quite often and listen to what they've got to say. And quite often it's about, you know, I'm trying to stop war. I think war is a bad thing, but I think the motivations are not so always so altruistic. They're far deeper and go deep into people's personalities. So in terms of Burma, what was it? I was looking after children on my own. My wife had died killed in a car accident about 2.5 years before. So I was looking after three children, cutting school lunches, making beds, having fights with them, having them raise me. Just to take a step back, the car accident where my wife was killed happened at a time when I was on the cusp of some possible international career. And being international, for some reason, is important to New Zealanders, and I'm not quite sure why. But there I was. So 2.5 years later, I'm still in a little box house in a satellite suburb of Auckland, wondering how do I get out of this. And up on the television one night, after I'd chased the children to bed, came this short 15-minute doco on by an Australian documentary film crew of a ragtag army in trenches, for goodness sake, with bandanas and jandals, and I thought, that's where I want to go. There was my escape. So motivation, what's the motivation there? Is it because I thought I had some feeling for the Karen, that was the ethnic minority of the Karen fighting against the Burmese government? Not at all. I didn't feel strongly for them, and in some ways still don't, other than a normal sort of, at a normal humanist level. Made a few phone calls, organised a contact, and before long I'd left the children with the next door neighbour and headed off to war. And spent about five weeks up there, wandering about, and the idea was to go and have a look at at this trench warfare. But of course, there wasn't just trench warfare, and whatever you see on television, you always know there's a whole lot more going on beyond the peripheries of what they've been able to show. There were trenches, there were refugees in Thailand, Karen refugee camps. I came across a New Zealand mercenary that I didn't know was there. Now, New Zealand and Australia seem to have mercenaries all around the world. They always become involved in conflicts anywhere for some reason. But a New Zealand mercenary, Ian Travis, when I first arrived there, the Secretary General of the Karen National Liberation Army had me over and asked whether I knew Ian Travis. And I said, no, I don't know Ian Travis. And they were suspicious because, like any army, there are factions. And a New Zealander arriving, when there was already a New Zealander there in a fairly senior military position running raiding parties, they thought that I was coming there to be involved somehow with that. But in fact, I was there as a photographer to have a look. So he sought me out, and we arranged to go out into the field, which I wasn't keen to do, but finally I did, and we went out for 8 days, which is where the title of the book comes from, to lay an ambush. We went wandering on the way to an ambush.
Are you scared when you...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Is it all the time, or is it...
Well, the funny thing is with... I mean, maybe it's different for people, but in this particular situation, and I'm not a war photographer, I mean, I'm a social political documentary photographer, but in that situation, what struck me and was, I remember getting up to a fort, a Karen fort, right on the, just at the beginning of enemy territory, if you like, way up in the hills, and I remember looking down, and I mean, the Burmese jungle, the bush was just beautiful. And you look at these mountains like an airline poster, you know, disappearing into the mist. And the and I thought, it was almost impossible to imagine the killing that went on down there. The army patrols wandering around, the mines on either side, all this killing going on. And that, in fact...
Amidst the beauty of that...
That's the extraordinary beauty. But see, I mean, I come back to New Zealand on that, and I was involved in a project. I mean, we'll come back to Burma in a moment. But I was involved in a project photographing the New Zealand land war battle sites from the mid-19th century. And of course, all those battles came and went, and the land is just normal. So beforehand, it was normal. Then this appalling event happened, and then afterwards it became normal. But if you know the history and you go to those particular places, it becomes quite eerie. And there were places where we had a map that had been produced in the 1920s for some of these battle sites. And we would have to go walking through farmland and over hills and beside rivers, looking for a little landmark that was drawn on this map. One was in Taranaki, and it showed a set of steps cut into the earth 150 years before. And finally, we found them. And you thought, this is incredible that this is here. And then we turned around, and it was low afternoon sun on this particular occasion, and you could see the zigzag of Maori trenches still in the farmland, the dairy land of, as you look towards Mount Taranaki. And it sort of became exciting because you were in a place that wasn't even considered a killing field, and yet killing had happened here. Burma had the same thing, that, and it struck me that... that you very quickly become unaware of what went before, unless you have a particular knowledge of that history, that particular history, that sort of great beauty can hide the nastiness that has gone on or will go on or is going on, but. Burma became, I mean, I was there to photograph this war, so I photographed in the trenches, I photographed a bit in the refugee camps, and I photographed on this journey. But like everyone in Burma, I managed to contract malaria and came back to New Zealand and became very ill and hospitalised and nearly died because it wasn't treated properly. And it took me a long while to recover. But the only thing interesting about that is that it stopped me looking at the project when I came back. And if I'd looked at it immediately, it would have been a series of pictures about the war, and that would have been the end of it. But I left it for 2 years before coming back to it, and I was encouraged to come back to it by a wonderful writer, one of the Booker Prize finalists, Lloyd Jones. I sat down while he was writing a book on Albania, and told him my story, and he said we must do a book about this. And what I discovered when I started telling the story to him that it wasn't just about the war, that it became about my wife's death, the reason for going there. It became about the capriciousness of death. It became about beauty, hiding, killing fields. It became about all of those things. So what we decided to do was go to his house, and over about five sessions we taped my story, which to my surprise covered all this personal stuff that that had happened, not just with my wife, with the kids, and other people as well. It became about my life, but not in an overly sentimental sort of way. But and the idea was to take that material that we'd taped and just do a bit of an edit and have that as the story. But more and more, I realised that that the way in which I talk is repetitive, a bit dull, not quite well-structured sentences. So I took the material as a starting point and began to write. And Lloyd, who, was extraordinarily generous, I would finish a chapter, which I didn't even realise was a chapter at that stage, but I'd finish writing, because I'm not a writer. I had written, but I'm not a writer. And I would give him the copy, and it would come back. And Lloyd's a very straightforward person, so I'd get notes on the copy. Don't be so fucking stupid. You're kidding. Great cross-outs. Try again. And every now and then there'd be a very good. And I'd go, wow. And whenever I read what I'd written that had don't be so fucking stupid, I'd start to laugh because he was quite right. And I suppose the tendency, it's like photography as well. If you're at the beginning of photography, you tend to overextend your statements, when in fact it's better to learn restraint. And my writing is very much like that. So this whole book became a piece of writing, a bunch of photographs, and then I had letters and faxes that had been sent from the children while I was away. So those elements all had their own stories. And I was sent letters by, when I came back to New Zealand, by Travis, the mercenary, that were just extraordinary, because he told me about what had happened, events that they blew up a power station, or they bumped into a Burmese patrol, killed two and chased the others away. A tiger leapt at them and was shot by one of the scouts, but after two other scouts had been mauled by it, one of the scouts died at the spot and another one died when they got home with him. And then Timu, who was Travis's offsider, ate the penis. I mean, these are letters that I got. So the letters of the story after I left became part of this book as well. And I always felt I had these three parts that I never really believed could make a book. But finally, when I put it down on the floor and began with the first image and the text, I realised very quickly that it was going to work. And at the end of the sequencing and editing, I put it all together, wrapped a rubber band around it, gave to Catherine, the organiser of Typeshed 11, this extraordinary designer, and went off to India with my eldest daughter for her 21st birthday. 3 weeks later, I came back, and the mock-up of the book had been completed. So,
you said something earlier about great beauty can hide. Do you think that can also be you have a beautiful book, and maybe that can hide the message because you are so overwhelmed by the beauty of the photograph itself?
Well, I think that can happen, and it's a danger. I mean, the restraint is always required, but finally, it's the message is not a straight, direct message. The message is like life. It's a little bit grey here and there, and it requires effort. by anyone who looks at it to get the full idea. Even for the author to get the full idea, what have I done here? What is this, and the meanings can change depending on what stage of life you're through. Again, your mood on any particular day. It's an interesting thing with photography. Sometimes you look at photographs and think, how did I get into the mental space or into that situation to be able to take that photograph when you're back home drying dishes or cleaning the toilet or cutting school lunches?
Your current project is I Must Behave, which you're working on now. What is that?
I Must Behave is a completed project. The book is being printed now, but it deals with the notion of control, behavior within society. So, in a way that looks at ordinariness as being part of that control, that we behave in certain ways. And I mean, thank goodness we do. We stop at red traffic lights. We are prepared to stand in a queue. We eat with a knife and fork, or in a way that our culture says we should eat. So it's looking at habits,
conditioning,
traditions. Conditioning, certainly, the way we're raised to behave in a certain way. So it's just looking at, and the photographs are taken about 10 different countries around the world, just wandering around the streets, mostly, not always, looking at things that are happening. And for the first time presented in a book with no text, other than on the end papers of this book, a sort of subtitle, a sideways glance at behaviour. So again, it will require people to be involved.
Why no text?
The photographs say it. If I had a text, it would be repeating what's in the photographs, and probably not as well. And at the last moment, while it was at the printers, I weakened and thought I should have a paragraph of explanation, this notion of control and behaviour, and I wrote something and sent it off to a writer friend of mine, who said, "Don't be silly, get it out of there." The photographs do it in a much broader way than the two rather ordinary sentences I managed to produce.
How would you like to be remembered?
I really don't expect to be remembered. You'd like to feel that you leave some legacy. Well, if there is any legacy, then maybe I've been fortunate in having a creative discipline that can leave something behind. But the photographs will disappear, the negatives will disappear, the books will fall into the ocean in the next major earthquake in Wellington.
You're thinking like a few million years ahead, right?
Not really. I mean, how long will something last? Inkjet prints now, they say 80 years, you know, as if this is fantastic. They're going to last 80 years. Well, you know, maybe my kids will see the end of my pictures quietly fading away. I don't know.
And are you at peace with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Why should if you take a broader look on life, we come, we hang out, and then we leave. Which again is the other book that I did is that notion of stopover. We're here temporarily. We're all migrants from somewhere to somewhere. I'm not quite sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Počúvate Type Radio. Type Radio.